This is Offstage and On the Air, performance number 605, the super duper pooper scooper cold but warming up edition. My name is Lisa Sheps, and I am joined, as always, by my hot, hot co-host, Miss Nicole Shiro.
Hello.
You're listening to us on KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby, streaming live at koop.org, and during the pandemic. As always, we are homegrown and pre-recorded. Stick with us. Forget your troubles and raise your cup. Step right up, feast your eyes on the wonders of this world. It is Wednesday, February 24th, 2021, 3 days post-ice-pocalypse. On the show today, we are re-airing our incredible interview from 2012 with Mr. Ben Vereen. And of course, there's going to be some news and some views of the world of theater in cold New York, cold Dallas, cold Austin, cold San Antonio, and cold Boise, Idaho. Stick with us.
Keep walking on, don't stop, don't rest. He's out here somewhere. I can feel the ice.
That song you just heard was Colder by the Minute from Frozen.
Yeah, that's how I felt.
Yeah, so last week I got power for about an hour and was able to post the show. So we were able to have a show last week. It was touch and go for a while. As a matter of fact, as I was putting the show together, I had power and then I lost power. So the second half of the show did not have any new music. I had to go back to music that I had on my hard drive. It was a crazy week. Did you survive okay?
I survived. I'm still warming up. That was worse than Sandy. 10-volt.
Wow.
Yeah.
And Sandy was bad.
Sandy was bad.
So now you can say you have PTSD from... We don't have a name for this yet. We need a name for it. The ice, I just call it the ice-pocalypse.
We've been calling it ice-pocalypse, or a bad word of 2021. I can't say on air.
The S-storm.
The S-storm of 2021. Yep. I tried telling you all 2021 was not going to be better, and no one wanted to listen to me.
Nobody listened
to
you.
Here we are in February, and it stinks.
Nobody listened to you. They should listen to you more often.
Nope. You know what I had to say? I blame it on J.J. Watt. He announced he's leaving Texas, and he took the Watts with him out of the whole damn state.
That's what it was. So I have a little story about the Frozen. This doesn't have anything to do with theater per se. I bought a drone so that I could do aerial photography, and I thought it'd be really nice to shoot my neighborhood in the snowstorm. Well, it appears that drones do not like freezing cold weather because it flew away. Gone.
You don't have it anymore?
No, it is gone. It flew 5 miles away and landed in some reservoir somewhere in Southeast Austin.
OMG, that's funny.
Yeah.
Well, my neighbor, I did sing Frozen during this. Our neighbor is born and raised in Texas. He has never seen snow. He has never shoveled. He was so proud of himself. We would come out on the porch to check on each other, and he was throwing snowballs. So I kept singing Frozen to him, and he was just giggling. He was like, I've never seen snow. I've never thrown a snowball.
Well, let me tell you, and then we'll start getting into theater news. I have lived in colder climates, and I realized how important a snow shovel is because I don't own one here in Texas. So I tried to shovel my walk with a regular shovel, which didn't really work.
I have a snow. The snow shovel was way in the back, but I'm a weird freak who owns ice shoes and crampons. So
you are a weird freak. Well, let's start so talking. Go ahead.
I was able to crunch, and then people could sweep away. So I was the ice machine. My body.
There you go. Well, I could not leave my house, and I lived at the bottom. I live at the bottom of a hill, and could not drive out until a couple days ago. Anyway, we're not here. This is not a weather show. It's Nicole.
No, don't need to relive it. I did it. We're good.
No, don't need to. So we do hope that our listeners are currently safe and warm and have water and not too much damage to their house. If you do have damage to your house or you still don't have water, I'm sending all of my love and care your way.
Yes. There's a lot of great resources. If you can't find them, email us and I have some links that we can send people to help them too, Lisa.
Yep. There wasn't a lot of news happening. Certainly there's no theater news in Austin because nothing happened for the past week. But in the New York Times, they had some interesting articles, and one was Jesse Green with the title of Attend the Tale of Anyone Can Whistle. Did you read that article?
I didn't read the article, but I did see the headline of it.
Well, this is interesting. So Anyone Can Whistle is a flop by one Stephen Sondheim. And it didn't do very well. This was his first foray into going into a little bit of non-generalized pop.
Not really the classic story.
Classic musical.
Yeah.
So he's now revered and loved for what he does and really making the music advance the storyline. And the music that he writes is very complex. And some people don't like it.
It's hard.
And Anyone Can Whistle was the beginning of that. Although, I love some of the songs. I love the song Anyone Can Whistle. Mm-hmm. I love the song. Oh my God. I'm going to try to, the trumpets. There won't be trumpets.
Mm-hmm.
I heard all those, not from the Anyone Can Whistle soundtrack, but from my, Side by Side by Sondheim soundtrack, which had all those on there. And I just love, you know, the Anyone Can Whistle.
Coffee in a Cardboard Cup, is that from Anything Can Whistle?
No, but that's a great song. Is that Sondheim?
No, that's,
I don't think that's Sondheim.
Never mind. I got Candor and Ebb in my head. Never mind. Ignore me.
Never. Anyone Can Whistle is such a beautiful song. It's Anyone Can Whistle, that's what they say, easy. And clever lyrics and beautiful. Anyway, so there's a
new... You know who taught me how to whistle?
Mae West. You just put your lips together and blow.
The band The Hooters.
Oh, okay.
Random.
1980.
Yeah. There you go.
Okay, with you. So there is a new recording. There was the original soundtrack recording a long time ago, and it of course... took out any, as most soundtracks do, they take out the dance breaks and a lot of this stuff, which evidently in Anyone Can Whistle were wonderful. And so they put that all out. It's a complete recording with all the music, and it's available. It came out in December, and I'm surprised I didn't hear about it till now.
Are you really surprised how much is going on in the news cycle between December and now?
That's true. So here's some interesting things that happened during the opening and around the opening of Anyone Can Whistle. It opened in 1964 on April 4th, and it had a whole bunch of trouble out of town. One actor had a heart attack in Philadelphia. A dancer caused a heart attack when she flew off the stage into the pit and onto a saxophone player.
Who had the heart attack? Her or the saxophone player? She just said she caused one.
She caused one, so it probably wasn't her. I'm guessing it was somebody else.
Yeah, I know. It was but it ended, someone else, you know?
That doesn't say. So other things that opened at that same time was Hello, Dolly, and Funny Girl. So they didn't really have a chance of any kind of recognition. So they didn't. It starred Angela Lansbury, It was written, the book was written by Arthur Lawrence. And let's see if I can get, here, this is from the article that Jesse Green writes in the New York Times. The gangly plot involving a venial mayorless faking a miracle, Angela Lansbury in the original production, a repressed nurse with a French alter ego, Lee Remick, and a psychiatrist who actually is a psychiatric patient, Harry Gardino, seem to be held together by spit and sarcasm. That sounds like a lot of fun to me.
It does.
Yeah, but nobody does it. Why is that?
I want to say, I feel like someone in the last 20 years, someone did it, but maybe
there was, I think there was a revival. Wasn't there a revival? I don't know. I thought there was an Encores revival. There was an Encores revival.
Okay. I'm like, I feel like I heard it. I mean, I didn't see it, but I think I remember hearing or remembering it.
Yeah. So, so folks can find the soundtrack on iTunes or any other places, and it's called The Complete. It's called the, Anyone Can Whistle. I believe it's called the complete something. That's what differentiates it. That's when you look at it that can differentiate. Okay. But interesting. So let's take a break and let's listen to A Parade in Town from Anyone Can Whistle.
Okay.
Parade in Town. So Parade has become a kind of a reoccurring theme with us. We played, I think 2 weeks ago, we played from Frank Lesser's Parade. I think it was Frank Lesser. And we talked about Robert. Oh, my God. Just lost his name. What's his name? Robert. He wrote Parade.
Oh.
I have the Jason Robert Brown. I have the poster right in front of me. So Jason Robert Brown's Parade, which is very different. But this is the Anyone Can Whistle. So it is out. It was out in December. It is produced by Jay Records, who does a lot of soundtracks, broadcast albums. So did you happen to see that the Shakespeare, the Center Shakespeare Company, American Shakespeare Center got rid of their artistic director and is not replacing them. And so it's going to be a Shakespeare company, as was done in Shakespeare's day, without a director.
Yeah, and they said they were, what was interesting is I found is they were in the process of moving to the directorless model. It said before this anyway, I was like, oh.
Yeah, as a director, I don't know how I feel about that.
I don't know how I feel about it either. I mean, I thought it was cool because I'm like, oh, that's very Shakespeare. That's the right people to do it. But then like, I don't know. I was mixed.
I think having that outside vision to see the whole thing, I would find it difficult. It's my same argument of having a director also be in the play. They don't see the whole picture because it's almost impossible.
I hear you. Yeah, I'm mixed about it. I mean, it's cool and it's not. But you know what? I'm curious now to see what they do, how it goes, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm.
So the American Shakespeare Center is in Virginia in the Shenandoah Valley, and it claims, and I don't know why they worded it in the New York Times, who wrote this, Michael Paulson, he says they claim to have the world's only replica of the indoor venue where Shakespeare's company performed. It seems to be that would be a pretty easy thing to prove or disprove.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, just want to say that.
I've never heard that before.
So they announced the artistic director, who's Ethan McSweeney, stepping down last Friday. He stepped down 8 days before that, but they don't say why.
Yeah, they don't say why, but it said like he had been planning on it or something, right? Or been thinking about it.
No, they didn't offer an explanation. McSweeney cited financial strain caused by the pandemic. But they had, and I think we talked about this, there were some complaints from the workplace climate. And I don't believe it was BLM or Me Too. I believe it was just not nice
management. Just good old not nice. Yeah.
I think, but I could be wrong. So feel free to correct me if I am, all of you folks out there in radio land.
So Tina and Ike Turner are both in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but Tina is finally being acknowledged for the work that she so well should be acknowledged for and is now a nominee in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It's open for the public to go in and do their voting. But in honor of that, Playbill and Broadway.com, all these places are taking small unseen footage of Tina working on the musical and of her background, and they're playing all of this right now. And it's so darn cool.
Oh, cool. I
just love Tina Turner.
Tell our listeners what musical you're talking about. I'm not sure that they know.
Tina, the Tina Turner musical.
There you go. Which hopefully will come back once we reopen.
Yeah, and it's the first one. London already announced the date we were talking about, which is weird. Hopefully she makes it in that Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That she deserves it. Like, hats off. The Go-Go's are in there. There's an interesting group.
Yep. That's cool.
I just the Go-Go's because they're another Broadway person. Who knew?
I would like to vote against Ike Turner being in that, but that's just me. And then the final thing I want to talk about is Music Theater International is going to do a big celebration once theater opens. And I have to say that I love this idea because, of course, Ground Floor Theater had it first. We were planning on that. Of course, that's when we thought we were going to open last year sometime. But they're going to do an all-new musical review available to perform free of charge for people all over the country for a big reopening celebration. It's going to have songs from Into the Woods, songs from the New World, speaking of Jason Robert Brown, Les Miserables, Guys and Dolls, and others.
Interesting.
Yeah, and this is an article in playbill.com.
.com. Did you see the one article about the touring version of A Chorus Line in Japan?
Yeah, that it played like 55 cities or something like that. But I didn't read the whole thing.
They were able to do 75 performances in 51 cities with up to audiences of 60,000. Interesting. It was the Shiki Theater Company, but the producer is Concord Theatrical, who does produce some of our tours.
Well, Concord Theatricals is Samuel French.
Right. So I want to read more and learn about where they went, what they did, how they did it. But I found that really fascinating.
Well, I have a challenge for you then. Get all the 411 and let's talk about it next week.
Yeah. Yeah. I just saw it this morning in the briefing and went, oh my goodness, I need to go down that rabbit hole. That is fascinating. And that's a really good sign to me.
Yep. I agree. So,
Chorus Line. So why not? Speaking of A Chorus Line, one of my good friends who did A Chorus Line with me just passed this past week. I found out during the storm. So
Paul
and I played Morales. So hats off to John Westcott. Talented, talented, talented guy.
Rest in power, John.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a little break. We're going to listen to a song. I don't know which one. From Songs for the New World by Jason Robert Brown.
Yes.
With the guns flaring and the drums pounding.
We are back. You're listening to Offstage and On the Air with Lisa
and Nicole.
You are listening to us on KOOP 91.7 on your FM dial, streaming live at koop.org. And as always during the pandemic, we are pre-recorded. Nicole, very little happened locally in the past week because we were all shut down. Ground Floor Theater postponed. We didn't even do our online stuff because people couldn't get online, and even though people could get online, people didn't want to go online. It was amazing how this affected the theater community, and just everybody just kind of shut down, myself included.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
So So there's
keeping warm with my brother and Liza Minnelli.
Yeah, there's not a whole bunch to talk about. We were going to have UT School of Theater and Dance on, but we decided to postpone that, and that will be on probably next week's show. Things are ramping up again here locally. And I do want a shout out again to our interview with Michael Meggs, who was just wonderful.
Sorry, I missed that.
And I think we all learned how to pronounce his name now. It is Michael Meggs, not Michael Meigs, as we all have been pronouncing it.
Meggs like legs.
Meggs like legs, like eggs.
Mm-hmm. You never heard me say that to you?
No. Nope, you have not. We are going to replay one of our favoritest interviews. We had so much fun with this person that we ended up with so much material that we played it in three sections. So what we're going to play today is
Tails in a Top Hat.
Yep. And of course, we're talking about the incomparable Mr. Ben Vereen, who came and joined us at the Co-op Studios for this interview. So it was really great. And we talk in this interview, we talk about his early career, and we end up the conversation talking about Jesus Christ Superstar, which, of course, he...
Judas, man.
He originated... I was trying to think of the word originated. Originated the role of Judas. And some of the things that he brought to the role that wasn't necessarily originally thought of by Andrew Lloyd Webber and company. So let's listen to that interview.
Tim Rice. Don't forget Tim Rice. He gets some credit in there.
I said in company.
Yeah, but he should get his name, Tim
You're
Rice,
right.
with Andrew Lloyd Webber. Sorry.
Unarguably, and it's definitive, and nobody can say I'm wrong about this, Andrew Lloyd Webber was only good when he worked with Tim Rice.
I have like one or two that I like, so I'm not going to beat that. But yes, I liked him more so as the duo. But okay. I don't like Joseph, so I mean.
I do. I love me some Joseph. So let's listen to this interview with Mr. Ben Vereen. We are fortunate enough to be here having live in the studio a theater legend, and I'm so excited to be able to introduce him to our audience. And so let's get right to it. We are here sitting in the studio with the one and the only Mr. Ben Vereen. Can I call you Ben?
Yes, please.
Thank
God. Mr. Vereen is my father.
That's so funny. Mr. Vereen is my father, too.
Really?
Yeah.
He got around.
He did. Well, welcome to...
Father was a Rolling Stone.
Welcome to Offstage and On the Air.
Thank you very much.
I think we were talking before we went on the air. I have to tell you how totally thrilled I am, and I know Nicole is, to have you here in the studio. You are somebody that's been part of my theatrical life, almost all of my theatrical life.
Thank you.
Mine also. You get referenced in my house. My brother and I reference you at least two or three times a week. You are a part of our daily existence.
Thank you.
There you go. So I just sort of want to talk about your early theater life to begin with and what brought you into theater to start with. Mm. So what got you there?
Desperation. You know what it was, right out of high school, a woman by the name of Vinette Carroll, she was doing a play at the Greenwich Muse Theater, and she asked me, she saw me in my concert at the finals of a high school recital, and she came to me right away and she said, I want you to do my play, The Prodigal Son. So I went down with her to Greenwich Muse Theater, and I was doing... Prodigal Son is what we did. And one night I came out from the dressing room and there was a man standing there. And he said, can I buy you dinner? And I said, sure. And he took me to dinner. And that was the beginning of a great relationship with a man named Langston Hughes.
Oh, my gosh.
And, yes. And you know, he took me to Harlem for the first time. And you know, he sat and talked to me about his career and his life. And it was wonderful. So that was the beginning of my journey. Later on, I went to Summerstock and came back to New York, and as most of us actors are unemployed.
Yes.
And I was unemployed. You know, oh, what are you doing? Oh, I'm doing great work. You're unemployed, aren't you? Yes. and I ended up looking at a backstage newspaper.
Right? Of course.
Newspaper. And there was an audition for a show called Sweet Charity. going to Las Vegas with a woman named Juliet Prowse. And that's where I met Bob Fosse.
And everything changed from there. Yeah. So you grew up in New York. You grew up in Bed-Stuy, didn't you?
In Bed-Stuy, yes.
That was a tough upbringing, I would assume.
Well, no, it was tough, but it was good. It was a good foundation. Uh-huh. You know, I still have people in Brooklyn who refuse to go to Manhattan. You know, I see them today, and I say, "Won't you come see my show?" They say, "You're going to be playing in Brooklyn?" I said, "No." I said, "We'll see you later."
Really?
Oh yeah.
That makes no sense.
They're devoted to Brooklyn. Devoted.
There are people like that. They leave. They stay in their borough.
Exactly.
They just don't leave their borough.
Well, the good news for them is that they're starting to do a lot more theater in Brooklyn.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. You know, matter of fact, I did my first show I ever did was at the Brooklyn Academy of Music.
One of our local girls that used to be from here, Gwen Kelso, is one of the education folks up at BAM now.
Oh, great. Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
So we have Austinites.
So you have a better pedigree than me. The first show I did was a production of The Fantastics in Sheepshead Bay in a church.
That's good. You know, any theater, any place, you know, Shakespeare says all of life is a stage. And any place we can express ourselves, that's where we need to be. You know, I have a program starting in 2014 called Path to Excellence Through the Arts. And the idea is to empower young artists who want to be in this business. We not only teach singing, dancing, acting, and music, but my dream is to also educate them in the ways of business. We have lawyers come up and teach them how to read contracts, because I know when I got this business, I didn't know how to read a contract. Accountants to come up and tell them how to take care of their money, you know, and how to read a checkbook and the importance of that. We also have doctors that will come and talk to them about the physical anatomy. We have vocal doctors, and we have life coaches, we have physical therapists and nutritionists that will be a part of the program, as well as my friends from Broadway and television and film will be coming out and giving lectures and things of that nature. It's a 4-week program. It's called Path to Excellence Through the Arts, because I believe that young people need to be empowered. You know, there are many programs out there, summer intensives, which are wonderful, but we need to empower these young people, let them know that they are the excellence in which they seek. And maybe if we do this, maybe we will empower them to do better. It will be a better society.
Yeah, I think that is absolutely
exactly.
Wonderful. One of the things that is so important, we talk a lot on this show about the importance of arts education and for
yes.
youth. And what I love about your approach is myself, like many people, found our way to New York and we thought that it was all going to be that show business was just about the art and the craft.
Yes.
But it's not. It's show business. And it's really nice
yes.
that you are looking to give young people the tools to not only excel in their craft, mm-hmm. but also excel in the business of theater.
Yeah,
so,
we also,
mazel tov.
We've aligned ourselves with career transitions for dancers.
Uh-huh.
They are part of our organization, which is important for dancers to know that after you finish dancing, there is a career waiting you, and you can start preparing for it while you're dancing. And because we don't think ahead, you know,
no.
we think in the present. And you know, and people got to remember, they call it show business, but it should have been titled business show.
It should.
This is a business.
Absolutely. And the dancing part is really huge too. And you, still a young man, but you're still dancing, correct?
Yes, I am. Yes,
but many people, just for a lot of physical reasons, and especially in the ballet world.
Yes.
There's not a lot of longevity there, so it's really important
not.
To plan ahead.
That's right.
So then you started working on a tour of Sweet Charity, and that's
yes,
where you
I
met
did.
Bob Fosse.
With Juliet Prowse and with Cheetah Rivera.
With Cheetah Rivera. Yes. Now, Sammy Davis was not part of that production.
No. When we came to Hollywood, and Bob asked us to do the film, which Shirley MacLaine.
Yes.
And Bob and Sammy Davis
right.
came aboard. And good friend.
Because you worked with him as well for
a lot of years.
Yes,
Golden Boy and, you know, Rise and Fall of Billy Baker. And yes, we got the way. It's an interesting story about the Rise and Fall of Billy Baker. And this is the type of character that Sammy was. He was doing a show called Mod Squad.
Remember
on,
it well.
On the Paramount lot. And I went there to, you know, to say hello. And, and you know, we're just actors, you know, we lie. He said, well, I said, what are you doing these days? Oh, he says, well, yeah. I said, well, yeah, you know, I'm working on a script at the studios. And I'm going to, he said, you're unemployed. I said, yes, sir, I'm unemployed. And he said, look, son, I'm doing a show called Rise and Fall of Billy Baker in Vegas. And why don't you come down and do it? The producers didn't want me on the set. Sammy paid me out of his own pocket just to be on the set.
Oh, wow. That's really...
He would do things like that. He was an amazing man. I love him very, very, very much.
So you have a reputation of sort of being a quintessential Fosse performer in a lot of ways.
Really?
But to me, there are people that are represented only by Fosse, that you really think of them, their names are almost, you say Fosse and their names in the same sentence, but not with you. Even though you are like the quintessential Fosse performer, you have that Fosse style, which those of us in the business just love and love and love. But you've sort of transcended that to be sort of a master of all trades within the show business.
No, thank you. I attribute that to Sammy Davis, because when I was in high school, you know, I heard him say on the air that, he says being a black man in this business is tough. He said, so I had to be better than my counterparts. So I'd have to be funnier than Jerry Lewis. I'd have to find ways to he said, I have to sing, I have to dance better, you know. So I heard that. And it sort of fell into my lap when we went to Las Vegas for the first time. And Vegas was Vegas. It's now Disney World for
adults.
That's
true.
But in those days, it was Vegas. And it was desert, you know, and there was a little place out in the desert there called the Left Bank, which is a dude ranch.
Right.
And the ladies who owned it had hired a piano player. And I'd come out there after my show, Sweet Chariot at Caesar's Palace. And we'd sit at the piano and just sing. Sing, you know. And that's how it all started. Yeah, I sang in church when I was growing up. But after the show, I'd have all this energy. And I'd go out there and there'd be two people in the house. And I'd sing and carry on. And every night I'd come up and practice. And then that evolved into me actually going to San Francisco. And a guy named Tommy Duckworth and Fred Merge, who was a trombone player, asked me to, and Tommy was a drummer, to put together a show.
Right.
So I wrote a show, and then we put it together. And my first song was, I think it was Sympathy for the Devil.
Sympathy for the Devil?
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and praise.
Wow. Now, was that before the Rolling Stones made it famous?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Down the street working for me.
The Rolling Stones made it famous because Ben Vereen sang it.
Exactly.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
So, Ben, one of the things that's really important for a theatrical performer these days, it's almost impossible to make a living in theater in New York without being a triple threat. So without being able to sing, dance, and act. That's something that you are, and I think that's probably an understatement. You can sing like the Dickens, you can act your way out of more than a paper bag, and you, of course, can dance. Was it, when you were first starting out, was that an important thing? If I was a young person in theater today, I would have to know all those things in order to even survive. Was it for you back then, or did you just... Were you just smarter than everybody else?
Thank you. I in those days, to be in the chorus, you had to sing.
Right.
You had to dance. And from working, you know, I'm the type of kid who would sit back and watch everybody. Watch how they act, how they play. And I'd go back home, you know, by myself, and I'd pretend to be them. I remember when I was... growing up in Brooklyn, I'd go to the movies and watch the movies, and I'd come home and I'd get the kids on the block and sort of direct them in the movie I saw, and I'd play a part, you know. So it sort of was an innate thing, you know, with me. And so when the opportunity came, it was with Sammy Davis and Golden Boy.
Golden Boy.
Yeah. And we were in Chicago. And Sammy had been, you know, going around, because Martin Luther King had just been assassinated. And he was going around the community, you know, telling the Blackstone Rangers to keep peace.
Right.
And so he got pretty exhausted. And I had no rehearsal. And I was not his understudy, but I was the Billy Daniel role, mm-hmm. You know, Billy Satin. I was his, who was played as an elderly man. And so Sammy decided he couldn't do the second half. And they looked at me and said, "You're on." And so Lottie Satin went on for Billy, went on for Sammy, and I had to come up with an idea. And so I had to come up, I thought to myself, I said, I can't be as old as this guy.
No, because you were probably in your early 20s.
So I went around, I got all these costumes, got made me a costume, and I went to Sammy and said, "Can I borrow your shades?" He said, "What?" I said, "Can I borrow your shades?" And I got the shades, I put them on, and I came around and played the kid of Billy Satin.
Oh, there you go.
And Sammy Satin rings wings and he watched me. And it was my first standing ovation.
How exciting.
And I walked off stage and Sam said to me, "I knew it all the time." And he walked away.
Oh, my gosh. What a great story. And that was, you know, that was back when a standing ovation truly meant something, too.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. They still do. They still do. It's lovely when an audience stands to their feet to show their appreciation that they've been touched in some way by a performer. You know, that they touch your heart. And because usually, for me, performing is not just a show. It's a statement of love. So when love reaches out and touches them and it moves them to stand on their feet, that touches my heart.
Right. You know? And you're pouring your soul out there. And it's always nice to get a little bit back.
It's wonderful when audiences do that for performers. Right. You know?
Your career in theater is just marked with such incredible incredible shows that you are involved in. It's like almost when you look at the list of shows that you've been in on Broadway, they're always iconic, very important pieces. And you started in the chorus of Hair back in the day, didn't you?
No. My first chorus was Sweet Charity.
No, I mean, but I'm just talking about in Hair. That's where you started.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you worked your way up to playing Hud, I think, right?
Yes, playing Hud. And I was Hair.
Well, and the wonderful thing about Hair is the revival that happened, what, 3-4 years ago was just an incredible revival.
Yeah.
Different. Oh, okay.
The jury's still out.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Did you not like it?
No.
Okay.
I did not.
I'm curious. Why not?
Because it's hard to understand what you've never been.
I understand.
Oh, you're absolutely.
Saying.
You see, during the time when we did Hair, we were in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Vietnam. We were in it. The civil rights movement. We were in it as people. We had the passion for it. And to instill that in the cast is very important.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to understand that, you know, it's not over.
Right.
No.
The movement
true.
Is not over. And I felt that they did the cast, or I don't know who, the director or whomever, they didn't really plug in that important ingredient. You know, when they came out and did the nude scene, it was like, "Look, I'm standing on stage naked, mommy." You know, it's not
which
that.
It really,
which
yeah, it really that. Isn't. It's I've not explained that to
it's
people.
It's about, you know, what a piece of work the human body is.
Right.
What God has created, or Allah or Buddha or Jesus, whatever you call it to be, has created a wonderful piece of artwork. You know, in the beginning it says God created man and woman in its image or his image. And we are walking, talking art pieces. And we were saying in our time, look at us. You're destroying this.
Right.
You're battling this. You're violence against what God has created. Stop it. And I didn't feel that in this show. I felt like, "Oh, mommy, I'm naked now." Okay, and they came out, did the new scene, and walked away.
Yeah,
there wasn't an understanding of the lyric, nor I'm not really criticizing. But it's my opinion, is that, you know, they didn't. I felt that they didn't have an understanding of the depth of what they were doing. Now, for them, they may have felt that, but for me, as a Hair person, having been through it. My want for them is they get it. Right now, to me, that show is like a good Vegas show.
Yeah, I absolutely see your point. Mm-hmm. And it's got to be very difficult, especially for someone that has gone through. So when you, as you said, when you did Hair, you were living it. It was part of you. It was part of your soul.
We were living it. We were in the cut. And these, this cast right now has got to, I want my one, and I'm saying this on the air, is my one is that they understand that what they are doing and living in right now, they've got to be more passionate about what's going on around the world. You know, our troops over in a foreign land, you know, and foreign lands are being, right here in America, we have homelessness. We have so much going on. Don't you feel anything for that?
So your challenge for that cast is to take what's going on right now, feel that passion and bring it back to hair.
Feel that and bring it back.
Yeah. When I saw a tour of hair back in the 60s in Houston. Mm-hmm. Were you there? Did I see you?
No, I didn't do Houston.
Rats. So I was...
I did L.A., San Francisco.
I think I was like 10 or 11
Chicago,
years old when I saw it. But hair, which led to your role at Jesus Christ Superstar.
Yes.
Which is so exciting.
I did a show called No Place to Be Somebody in San Francisco at my first concert. And Tom O'Horgan asked me to come to New York to do Jesus Christ Superstar. And that was an amazing time because, you know, once again, it was another show that rubbed society the wrong way.
Exactly.
We were talking about Jesus and rock and roll, and there was blasphemy. And, you know, nuns would come out and protest. You know, they'd be hitting us with their rosary beads. Hey, you can't write blasphemy.
And it hurts to be hit with rosary beads.
It does, you know. And, but what we were trying to say is we're talking about love. We're talking about a man who, he said, the question was, how much do you love me? And he stretched out his arms and died for us.
And you took the role of Judas.
Yes.
Who the world demonizes,
yes,
and you made him human.
Yes, because my whole idea of Judas is, one, first of all, two important people have not wrote the book. That's Jesus and Judas.
Right. Yes.
So what was really going on? And you have your own interpretations. I'm sure, you know, historians have come up with things, but you weren't there. And my thing was that Judas really loved Jesus deeply. As a matter of fact, they've come out with a book about talking about how they had a great relationship. And so I'm thinking, when I, at that time, I'm thinking, why would this man betray someone that he loves? It's not for 30 pieces of gold. That doesn't make sense to me. So my thought was, maybe he saw all the rivalry going on about Jesus. Millions of people just screaming his name. He said, you know, we got to change his government. So maybe if I put Jesus in the hands of the enemy, the people will overthrow the government and make him king. And that didn't happen.
Right.
And so when it didn't happen, he, of course, had to kill himself, you know, because, you know, he couldn't bear it. You know?
Well, that's incredible.
That was my interpretation, so that helped me get through it.
Well, and that's the interpretation that everybody does now. So you handcrafted that.
Oh, thank you.
So that was a great thing. Let's take a little break right now.
Yes.
And we will come right back talking to Ben Vereen.
Listen, Jesus, I don't like what I see.
Oh my God, did that take me back to simpler times?
Our picture of us with him pops up every once in a while in my scrolling stuff.
Yeah, mine too.
I look like a deer in headlights. I'm like, couldn't I have looked better in my picture with Ben Vereen?
So he's still going strong. He's a million years old right now.
I don't know if he's a million, but yeah, he hasn't stopped. He really just hasn't stopped.
Yeah. That was just so good to hear that again. And, you know, maybe we'll, you know, play some of the other two as well. I believe one of them had to do, he happened to be in town doing a fundraiser for, I think, diabetes. And so that was more timely. So we wouldn't play that section. But maybe we'll play one of the other sections where we talk about
stuff. He talks about the organization that he works with and does other stuff. I mean.
Yeah. So. But it was really good to hear from him again. Well, I think that we've just about done it.
We did.
And, you know, we started the show out playing Disney's Frozen, Colder by the Minute. And since, you know, what a difference a day makes, it's going to be 70 degrees today. So we're going to play Gonna Be Another Hot Day.
Oh, I didn't know where you were going to go with Another Hot Day or Let the Sunshine In. I was in my head like,
Let the Sunshine In is good. I didn't think of that.
One or the other.
Maybe we'll do both if we have time. Gonna Be Another Hot Day is from 110 in the Shade. If we play Let the Sunshine In, that is from Hair. We'll see you later, folks, when we look at what's happening offstage and on the air. Adios.
Ciao.
Overhead, the sun is rising. Not a cloud across the sky. Not a sound.